Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. Happy Sunday to all of you, regardless of wherever you may live in the world. For some of you, it's probably already Monday, but what I do know is that it's hard to believe that we're already into the start of March. When I was on the air last, we were wrapping up February. Now, I don't know where all the time has gone, but it sure is moving quick, but that's just what happens when we get older in life, to say the least. But I am glad to be back on the air, and I'm sure some of you were beginning to wonder, when was Kirk going to be back on the air again next? Well, good news to report is that I'm on the air with another podcast segment episode to the Battle of Lake Champlain, a brilliant and extraordinary victory by John H. Schroeder. I tell you, we really covered a lot of essential ground from the previous podcast segment episode, given that this battle for Lake Champlain has officially begun. You know, battles just don't happen overnight. I mean, it does take time for the lead up of a major battle to take place. Oftentimes, we do have to be reminded that skirmishes or other smaller engagements took place, say, a couple of days before the official battle commences. But regardless, it's always easy to assume that whenever a battle takes place by land or by water, we tend to often assume that it's just everything is happening right at that instant moment when the actual battle takes place. It doesn't. Even preparing for a battle does take time. It may not necessarily take months, but it can take weeks. It requires gathering as much intelligence information as there is possible for both sides. And by gathering intelligence, you are studying or have observed where the enemy might be encamped, how the enemy is going to utilize its forces, where can we best strike the enemy in terms of outflanking them, where can we launch guerrilla warfare style tactics against the enemy. In other words, how can we go about harassing them without fully disguising ourselves to where eventually we can wear them down by the time a larger scale battle takes place? So, in other words, when we think of battles that happen, for example, not to get off track, but like when we take the American Revolutionary War, for example, when we think of battles like Yorktown or Saratoga, Bunker Hill, the list can go on and on. But yes, those are major battles, but they weren't battles that just happened on one day. There were other incidents or other, say, skirmishes or other kinds of military activities taking place prior to the lead up. You know, say, like, for example, when I think of Yorktown, I think of October 19th, 1781. Well, yes, General Lord Charles Cornwallis did surrender to General Washington on October 19th of 1781, but that doesn't mean that the entire battle itself happened on that official day. It just so happened to be the official day in which the surrender of Yorktown took place, but the siege of Yorktown lasted for more than a week. I want to say that the siege of Yorktown lasted at least 5 weeks, but heavy fighting was going on prior to October 19th. But it's just one of those reminders that we have to be reminded that when a battle takes place, it's not always just confined to the day that that the official battle takes place in terms of whom is automatically declared the winner and whom is the defeated party. So it's just a general reminder of what we need to be reminded of. Now, I do know in this next podcast segment episode, we're going to learn some other things about the outcome of the naval battle with regards to, well, based upon what we learned from the previous episode, we did learn that Captain George Downey was killed instantly, and that was a significant loss for the British, not only with regards to leadership, but really with the chain of command and how the chain of command responded following Captain Downie's death. I think it is fair to say that there were some British officers who did fight valiantly along the waters, to say the least. But we will find out with regards to... I will point out that we will need to learn about some other information with regards to how everything comes about with how the British go about surrendering to Master Commandant Thomas McDonough. We will also learn about how the American Army prevailed at Plattsburg, but it was one of those battles on land that... It was one of those battles on land that, you know how the saying goes that, you know, victory is within your grasp. And of course, depending on the side that you're on, if victory is within your grasp, wouldn't you want to just seize the day, seize the moment that lies before you? Yes. But at the same time, we have to understand why the British did not seize the opportunity that they had by land. I think it will really shock you. I think it will really take many of you by surprise and ask yourselves, if I was George Prevost, why did I make these decisions? You know, yes, we've learned by now that Prevost is a cautious commander, but even cautious commanders need to, they need to retweak their thinking, even if it involves doing so when it comes to split decision making. I think it's easier said than done because we're not in their shoes, but at the same time, we have to ask ourselves, if we were that officer, wouldn't we want to do something a little differently? And at the same time, if we were an officer below Prevost, how do we respond to the decisions that we will learn that Prevost himself has made? I think it'd be fair to say it's for better and it's for worse. But what I do know is that we have a lot of ground to cover before we lose track of time. So let's get started here with our next podcast segment episode. So here we go. Exactly. How long had the naval battle on Lake Champlain lasted? How long do you all think that the naval battle on Lake Champlain lasted? It turns out that it lasted for nearly 2.5 hours. 2.5 hours, folks, of intense fighting. I mean, we learned from the previous episode that that based upon what we had, you know, learned about with damage to each side's ships, because each side did endure its fair share of damages per the key vessels, most notably on the American side, USS Saratoga, USS Eagle. For the British, HMS Confiance, HMS Lynette. I mean, those ships, for example, I mean, they endured their fair share of damage, and yes, they did inflict damage. Both sides inflict damages to the opposing side, but in a fight that lasted 2.5 hours by water, on water, just about anything was foreseeable in terms of both sides inflicting damages to one another's ships. The majority of the British and American gunboats had survived overall combat. However, Britain's four frigates, aka her warships, were either destroyed or disabled, whereas for the United States' four largest ships, they also endured extensive damage. HMS Confiance's hull took 105 hits. 105 hits, during which a battle itself lasted 2.5 hours. That's a lot of hits to endure during that time period. Whereas for USS Saratoga, she took on 55 hits directly to her hull. And as for HMS Lynette, she had 50 total hits to her hull versus USS Eagle's 39. And to think, folks, that these are wooden ships. I mean, it's fair to say that if they lasted this long in 2.5 hours of fighting, that these ships could be considered strong examples of survival of the fittest. But even after 105 hits for HMS Confiance's hull, and she was out of commission, then we also have to say that maybe she simply, I mean, she lasted as long as she did, but after 105 hits, I don't see how a ship could no longer be considered survival of the fittest. I found this rather fascinating, and we do have to be reminded that even in times of war, not just by land, but even by water, that people from a distance can watch what's going on, the bystanders, perhaps the residents of a community or a town, village. They are impacted. I mean, that's an absolute yes. I mean, you would think that most residents, if they are afraid for their own personal safety, that they would evacuate the town, go somewhere, maybe into a village that's more populated, or go somewhere where it's more rural, where the chances of them getting caught by the enemy might be more reduced. But ironically, history has often told us that many residents within a village or a town, it was this way during the American Revolutionary War. There were some, most notably at Bunker Hill, there were residents who lived on the outskirts of where this battle took place that watched the battle from a distance. They saw the carnage from a distance, and they realized that even despite the British winning that battle and knowing that a quarter of their army was killed or wounded by the Continentals, they all realized that at this point there would be no turning back. In other words, we have fired the shots. Yes, the first shots were fired around the world at Lexington and Concord, but even at Bunker Hill, knowing that a group of ragtag soldiers, being Continentals, were able to go head-to-toe with the world's mightiest army and kill or wound up to 1,100 troops. About 25% of the British army was decimated that day. In case many of you are wondering, well, why did the British still win that battle? It's because the Americans pretty much ran out of ammunition. People are led to wonder if they had just a few more hundred men on their side with extra ammunition, they would have been able to have repealed or repelled that third and final assault by the British that day back from June 17th of 1775. But as for spectators whom witnessed the naval battle atop Cumberland Head, there was a fellow by the name of Julius Hubble, who was a 26-year-old native of Plattsburgh. He went above and beyond by not just going behind the scenes 101, but we can say that he went behind the scenes from a broader 101 perspective. He actually visited both the HMS Confiance and USS Saratoga. Regardless of whose side he went on to visit in terms of visiting the destruction that these ships endured, not only upon one another, but the wounds that they received in terms of taking hits from the enemy to their hulls. The crewmen, regardless of what side they were on, would have to wonder, why is this guy coming up out of nowhere and observing the damage? Could he be trying to gain intelligence about our vessels? Could he be trying to gain intelligence as to what our next moves would be? You just never know sometimes when innocent bystanders come about out of nowhere and will start making observations, and then you have to wonder what questions are they going to be asking. Well, Julius Hubble did not go about playing 20 questions with both sides, but what he did see firsthand up close was that for USS Saratoga, her seams, and that is spelled S-E-A-M-S, her seams, which are the gaps between two planks, that the seams of USS Saratoga contained large blood remnants. think about it, folks. You know, those whom survived didn't have time to take wet rags and go clean off the evidence. Not, you know, there's no crime scene, folks, but a battle itself could be like a crime scene of sorts. You know, the blood remnants should serve as a reminder that regardless of whose side you were on, casualties were the name of the game. People, crewmen on both sides were making sacrifices, and yet crewmen also did not have time to be able to sit back and analyze, okay, what direction is the cannonball coming? What direction is the grape shot coming? The cluster of three-pound grape balls coming out of a cloth launched from the cannon, what direction are they coming at so that I know how to get out of harm's way? Boy, wouldn't we love to have time and think to ourselves, what's the best way to escape the sudden firings coming at us from the opposing side? Nobody back then had that luxury. But you had to be very vigilant with the hope that if you dodged a bullet the first go around, that you'd be able to dodge another bullet. But anyways, for Julius Hubble, he not only did he see where USS Saratoga seams were still contained with large blood remnants, but he also saw a torn hull with masts and spars all discombobulated. Hubble saw up close where HMS Confiance was totally torn to pieces. Her decks were scattered with dead bodies from all directions, and everything visible covered in blood. Well, if I was in Julius Hubble's shoes, I would know already, based upon what I saw, that number one, war is not a game. Number two, regardless of who emerges victorious, that there are scars. And three, those whom survive, regardless of whether you are the victor or the defeated, the pain doesn't fully go away. Yes, you may emerge victorious, but if you survived, what about those whom didn't survive that you knew and had known for a while leading up to this campaign? Yes, you can celebrate a victory, but for those whom died, they too paid the price by sacrificing their own lives so that innocent Americans, not only living in Plattsburgh, but well south of Plattsburgh, all the way down into the Chesapeake Bay region, might be able to wake up the next morning with a little bit of more sunlight. And what I mean by sunlight is knowing that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and knowing that, okay, we may have a chance of still surviving as a nation, even in the midst of all the carnage that has unraveled over the past couple of weeks. Despite the British Navy's denial, I know this is going to sound crazy to mention, but I'm just going to point it out, Commandant Thomas McDonough had claimed that the USS Saratoga had been set on fire purposely from Confiance via the use of hotshot. There was an unusual number of splinters from the ship's decks and hulls that were frequently flying around. Missiles became deadlier in part to using softer pine and oak versus the opposite being heavy seasoned oak, which was cannon preference or choice in building most warships at that time. Havoc created and inflicted to enduring per each side was very surreal, traumatic. Even one survivor admitted that everything he wore was all torn apart into rags. Think about it, folks. You got your uniform on. That doesn't mean your uniform's going to stay intact the entire time. Your uniform can even endure not just a hit by a cannonball, but even splinters from missile firing can get torn into your outfit, to where your body could be exposed to where you might endure a couple of wounds. So just because you wear a uniform, it doesn't mean a uniform can protect you 100%. All a uniform can really do is, one, provide you with some clothing. It represents the country that you are representing. But a uniform can't protect you from all of the firings that the enemy ships will launch against you. Did HMS Confiance endure the heaviest of losses? Yes. 58 men were confirmed dead with 116 wounded. I think we often forget that the greater casualties are those whom are wounded versus those whom died. But at the same time, those whom die can be even greater than 100. It just so happens here that there were more wounded than those whom actually died. British crewmen survivors, folks, this is sad, but it's very surreal. It happened. British crewmen survivors were forced to throw some of their deceased comrades overboard in the midst of the battle, just to have extra room to fight. I can't imagine having to throw overboard some of my deceased comrades, knowing that they sacrificed their own lives, but knowing that they would not get a proper burial. You know, just because someone dies on the spot, that doesn't mean that we have time to take them to a little morgue nearby and make sure that they get the proper services before giving them a proper burial. We have to be reminded, even in times of war, not everybody gets a proper burial. And for many days after the battle had taken place at Lake Champlain, a good number of deceased British crewmen's bodies were found floating in Cumberland Bay. 52, that represents the number of dead from the USS Saratoga. 58 of those of the wounded were severely wounded. As for another 90 whom got wounded, they endured minor wounds. So here's another reminder that just because you get wounded, it doesn't mean you are severely wounded. You can receive minor wounds, but just because you receive a minor wound, it doesn't mean that the scars don't go away. We should be reminded that if you do get a minor wound, that you still endure the same scars as someone whom endures a severe wound. And we also have to remember that there's no such thing as post-traumatic stress syndrome in this day and time. A disorder in terms of diagnosis, that won't be revealed until much, much later in time. But in the early 19th century, there is no such thing as post-traumatic stress disorder. What made American officers and Master Commandant Thomas McDonough and Brigadier General Alexander Macomb so great? I think it's fair to say that we've already learned some things about these two guys in terms of their teamwork prior to the battle, but I do believe it's important to reiterate it right now. For starters, both men cooperated well with one another, which made pre-battle or beginning preparations go so smoothly. Secondly, both officers agreed to their objective, including how forces per each side would achieve the mission before them. Third, Brigadier General Alexander Macomb sent soldiers below him to fill in the gaps within McDonough's squadron, which was somewhat undermanned. Well, if you're going to defeat the mightiest empire from a militaristic standpoint, whether it's by land or by water, but here you have a dual campaign. It's not just one side. It's not one branch's campaign. It's both branches' campaign, Army and Navy. But if you're going to do it, you have to work as effectively as possible. You might have some differences, but you've got to work out your differences in a constructive manner, because if you don't, then how are you going to achieve the objectives before you? And to think that McDonough's squadron was somewhat undermanned, we do have to be reminded that most men wanted to be in the Army more so in the Navy, because for one, the Army did pay a little bit better than the Navy, and two, enlistment in the Army didn't have longer years in terms of number of years of enlistment, whereas the Navy did. But knowing that that McDonough's squadron was somewhat undermanned, Brigadier General McComb was kind enough to modify the circumstances and say, hey, I will send you X number of men so that you will not have so that your deficit in terms of a shortage of staff isn't at such a great disadvantage come time in which this actual battle takes place. The irony to it all is that there were more instances or frequencies that actually took place within the United States' side, resulting in officers engaging in bickering to showing discord. It is very fair to say in the case of Master Commandant Thomas McDonough and Brigadier General Alexander McComb, they had proven to be a top-notch working duo. The only other example I could think of during the War of 1812, in the early onset of the war, after the year 1812, was the year 1813. You had General William Henry Harrison, whom took over in the West. He ultimately replaced Brigadier General William Hull after the whole debacle at Detroit. General William Henry Harrison held off two sieges at Fort Meigs in what is now present-day Perrysburg, Ohio. He basically, in both sieges, helped American forces repelled British and Indian invasions, to where their side of Fort Meigs is not far from Lake Erie, but where the British were not able to break. Not only were they not able to seize Fort Meigs, but break further into Ohio. And by defeating the British and the Indians in Ohio, they were eventually able to team up with Master Commandant Oliver Hazard Perry, whose forces defeated the British at Lake Erie in September of 1813. With the Americans' victory at Lake Erie, this enabled Harrison's forces to go into Canada and defeat the British. Not only were the British forced to abandon Fort Malden, but the British were ultimately defeated at Moravian Town, or at the Thames, in October of 1813. But thanks to both men in that situation, Harrison and Perry working together, Perry's leadership, the Navy helped transport Harrison's forces into Canada, where they succeeded. So I think those are, to me, the two best examples that I know of at this point in time where both Army and Navy did work together for the good, given that this has been, for America, this war has seen a lot of ups and downs, and knowing that here the nation's capital was burned just a few weeks earlier, and now so many Americans are wondering, is it just going to be a matter of a short period of time before the United States doesn't exist as a nation anymore? Are we going to eventually wake up to seeing British flags occupying our towns, villages? Are we going to see our government crumble to where it no longer exists? And as I've said before, and I'll say it here again, the United States is at a breaking point here in terms of government funding. President Madison has to come up. He's got to see to it that the United States military can come up with some huge victories to assure the American people that we're not going to collapse. It's not so much these victories, but can the government find ways to keep funding this war? Because who knows when this war will end, but it has to end at some point here soon, because if it doesn't, then how can the government keep functioning? Commandant McDonough's performance was stellar. He had properly placed his fleet in a position, forcing the opposition to fight on their terms within a restricted space. He basically forced the British to come down into Cumberland Bay, which was only 2 miles wide. So it doesn't really give, it never really gave the British enough room to work with. And by the time they made it down there, they really were not able to get themselves in proper position. By engaging the Americans within close range, Captain George Downey had a more reduced advantage, given that his 27, 24-pound long guns were firing in shorter ranges versus longer ranges. You know, those 27, 24-pound long guns could fire well within 1,000 yards, but when it got to about 500 yards, those long guns weren't considered to be of significant use, because by the time they got into closer range, McDonough's carronades, however you pronounce them, they became more lethal at 500 yards when firing the carronades that required smaller gun crews. Their results could be very deadly. But when Captain George Downey was killed by cannon fire, his death contributed to a breakdown in British naval leadership via means of communication. Now, is it fair to say that the inexperienced gun crews of HMS Confiance was pivotal behind their defeat? It turns out it was. Many of these gun crew members, they didn't have a whole lot of experience, but because they didn't have a whole lot of experience per what they were going up against, they did not know how to properly reset the coins. And I'm not talking, you know, I know it sounds like money, C-O-I-N-S, but this is Q-U-O-I-N-S, quans or coins. That's referred to as gun wedges. So they did not know how to properly reset the gun wedges after each round per firings, thus resulting in the gun crews raising their guns' heights, which ultimately reduced damage to USS Saratoga. Had they not raised the guns' heights, they would have probably been able to have inflicted more damage to Saratoga. The British Army... Now we're going to talk about the British Army here. So now we're going to learn more about why the British Army... We're going to learn as to how they started off strong, but why they failed out of nowhere. The British Army planned for their attack not long or shortly after the naval battle began. Prevost, or I should say Governor-in-Chief Sir George Prevost, sought to have Major General Thomas Brisbane's brigade attack the two bridges across the Saranac River with guns from British cannon in Plattsburgh. The larger forces would be led by Major General Robinson. I want to say his first name is Alexander Robinson. Hopefully I'm right on that. I believe I wrote it down somewhere, but anyways, the larger forces were led by Major General Robinson with support by regiments under Major General Powers' brigade. They would all cross the Saranac River 3 miles to the west where it was shallower. And because it was shallower, that they saw this strategy as the better move because they knew that American defenses were not strong to the west. So after crossing the river, the objective then would be to attack General Macomb's key posts within Plattsburgh from the side and the back. Hey, a great plan lined out, to say the least. What does Brigadier General Alexander Macomb do in the meantime? He orders all volunteer fighters or militiamen to fall back along the road south towards the settlement of Salmon. By doing this, he kept the enemy from making entry into Plattsburgh. Well, you certainly don't want to expose your own men, but you also want to keep them out of harm's way. But this could also be seen as a game of cat and mouse where where you're doing everything you can to modify the situation before you, but you could also be trying to wear down the enemy so that when the time comes for the actual battle to be launched, you might have more men placed in different positions to where they will be more immune from an enemy surprise attack. Did Prevost's army attack U.S. fortifications in Plattsburgh? Yes. The army had success in damaging some of the enemy's structures. Now, I mentioned just a few minutes ago that there were two bridges across the Saranac River that would ultimately make their way into Plattsburgh. Of course, we could say you can make your way out of there, but at this moment, if you're on the British side, your objective is to not only attack these bridges, but wouldn't you think that once you've attacked them, if the bridges are still intact, that you could perhaps cross over these bridges and make your way into the Saranac River, or into the town of Plattsburgh, rather? Yes. Okay, so given that the army had success in damaging some of the enemy's structures, we would think that the enemy would have enough smarts to cross over the primary bridges. Well, I hate to tell you this, folks. If you're on the side of the British did not make any attempts to cross over these primary bridges, which could have led to their overtaking enemy positions in Plattsburgh. I don't know what's going on here, but what I do know is that the advance westward is very slow. Major General Robinson does not get the final orders from Sir George Prevost until after 8 a.m. The march itself does not begin until before 10 a.m. But due to no main road along the Saranac River, the British... Did you hear that, folks? There is no main road along the Saranac River. What does this mean? Well, for one, the British are up a creek. But secondly, the British had not done something prior to marching along the main road. But they hadn't done anything prior to this march in terms of the fact that they had not scouted nor located the best route upstream. So if you haven't done your homework ahead of time, such as scouting to not locating the best route upstream, then the chances of you being able to make it to your destination in a timely manner is going to be much more difficult. And who's to say that by the time you arrive there, that the objectives that you have had laid out are even going to be able to get met. So by 11 a.m. or just after, this is about the time when the British finally get to Pike's Ford, which was in the hands of the Americans, which was a vital crossing route via water. It's a ferry route. The delay in crossing the bridges earlier prevented the British from achieving a possible victory or a potential victory. Shouldn't the British have just crossed over these primary bridges when they had the chance? Yes. What are they thinking? Are they thinking that, oh, well, we've damaged some of the enemy's structures, they're just going to start running for their lives, and we have nothing to worry about, we've got time on our side because we have more men than they do? Well, you know, you could say all you want that you have more men than the opposition does, but if you have already knocked down some enemy structures and you have already created some kind of havoc, you've created fear, why not create a little bit more fear and start crossing over the rivers? Show the enemy just how mighty your force is. Show them what you're made up of. Start firing. I mean, once you've crossed over the bridge, start sending detachment groups in waves to where once they can start firing at people nearby, and they'll start creating even more panic. The bottom line is, seize the moment when it's there, because if you don't seize it, you don't know when you might get that opportunity next. You don't know if you'll have that opportunity an hour from now. So decisions have to be made in a timely manner. They have to be made on the spot at times. But when you make your decision, you better follow through with what else lies in store with that decision that you make. Because if you only can make a half commitment, then you shouldn't be leading the expedition. If you're only making half commitments and not finishing out the job, then you don't know really what those end results are. Did Prevost's officers and troops still manage to inflict firings at U.S. forces once having finished crossing Pike's Ford? That's the waterway route. They did. General Robinson had ordered Major General Powers' brigade unit to fire a 6-pound field gun, which resulted in seeing many militiamen retreating back to the Salmon settlement. So when you see the militiamen retreating, you should know that, okay, if they have broken line or if they are fleeing because they're in a state of panic, then this is where we better just seize the opportunity and stick a dagger in the American's heart. British victory, folks, appeared to be a near stroke away. It really did. It's a near stroke away. They've got the enemy just where they want them. I mean, I think if I was in General Robinson's shoes, he probably was ready to give the next set of instructions. I mean, Major General Powers' brigade has already fired a 6-pound field gun that has resulted in many militiamen retreating. They've got them on their ropes. Finish them off. But early afternoon on September 11th, something unexpected takes place. It takes place from within the British upper ranks, the inner circle. One of George Prevost's assistants, or an aide, has met up with Major General Philip Robinson, not Alexander Robinson, pardon me. This aide has met up with Sir George Prevost has met up with Major General Philip Robinson. He has delivered a message advising the outcome of the naval battle. There's more to the letter than just this, than just these two words. British defeat is one of the It was more than just British defeat, but part of a sentence had to have included British defeat. I'm sure that must have made Major General Philip Robinson's stomach churn, knowing that the Navy has been defeated. That's, to me, that would be news that would definitely make my stomach churn if I was on the British side. It would, I would have to literally cover my mouth. I would have to be shaking my head in disbelief, knowing what just happened. What was the matter with our leadership? How could this happen? How could a ragtag group of United States Navy men defeat our Navy? Well, if that's not bad enough, Sir George Prevost has instituted another set of instructions in this message for Major General Robinson to retreat at once. In other words, for Major General Robinson and that of Major General Powers, their brigades are to retreat at once. At 12 p.m. on September 11th, George Prevost issued an official order to end the ground attack altogether, hence removing all ground forces right away. Prevost was under an assumption that not far away lied a bigger number of extra U.S. troop reinforcements. What was Prevost thinking? My gosh, his army was almost at the cusp of victory. He did not even think for one second that Major General Philip Robinson was on the right path, that Major General Powers' brigade had fired a 6-pound field gun that saw many militiamen retreating back to the Salmon Settlement, probably in such a bad state of panic that they probably knew that this is the moment to go. This is the moment to seize it all. Were the generals under Sir George Prevost's command stunned and angry by the sudden decision to retreat, withdraw? Yes, and if I was an officer under George Prevost, I would be stunned and angry as well. So yes, these officers, like Major General Powers, Major General Philip Robinson, for example, these officers, for example, were veterans of the Napoleonic Wars, and they saw firsthand that Plattsburgh should have been seized without any issues. They were there. They knew what was in front of their eyes. These officers knew that if the primary bridges had in fact been crossed, Britain would have taken full control of Plattsburgh, thus eliminating altogether any threat, most notably from the United States Navy. The Navy wouldn't have been able to have backed up the Army here. At 9 p.m. on September 11th, Prevost started withdrawing his guns. At 2 a.m. on September the 12th, the entire Army had retreated. The weather had slowed the enemy's retreat. Matter of fact, it took about 2 weeks, folks, for the British Army to make their full retreat back north into Canada. It wasn't until September 25th that the British actually completed their retreat from the United States territory back into Canada. 2 weeks. You know, 2 weeks earlier, the British had pretty much achieved the utmost high of this campaign by burning America's capital. And 2 weeks later, maybe about 2.5 weeks later, on September the 11th, they have now endured a 360 setback that was just never crossed their minds that it would ever have happened. Were there any British troops whom deserted to the American side after the land battle had suddenly ended? About 234 British troops had defected. And many of these men were probably the ones whom did not even want to be in America. They had fought many of battles over in Europe in these Napoleonic Wars. They just didn't have it in them to want to fight another colonial war. But yet these troops probably had no real loyalty to Sir George Prevost. They probably saw him, they probably didn't like the fact that he was just too cautious of a commander. They probably knew deep down inside that he had squandered some opportunities, especially knowing that the bridges were viable to cross. They probably just did not like the fact that he was so cautious of a commander that he squandered such a bad opportunity to where if the troops had just crossed over those bridges and gotten a hold of Plattsburgh, that victory right there would have ended any further American retaliation. Now, for the four surviving commanders of the British Navy fleet, being Captain Pring, Lieutenants Robertson, McGee, and Hicks, they all came aboard the USS Saratoga to present their swords to Commandant Thomas McDonough. Now, when a surrender took place during this time, the defeated commander, or if the lead commander died, next in line would be in charge of presenting his sword to the victorious commander as a means of accepting his defeat. Master Commandant Thomas McDonough, however, did not accept the swords. He declined the swords, and he gave them back to the surviving fleet officers as a symbolic gesture. He did this because he knew that Captain Pring, Lieutenants Robertson, McGee, and Hicks, had gone above and beyond to keep the fight alive in their crewmen, knowing that Captain George Downey was killed instantly. He knew that, knowing that their communication had been severed, he felt as though their swords needed to be with them. Perhaps it's fair to say that those commanders along the water, if they give it their best, if they don't leave anything on the table, then perhaps they too should be treated humanely when it comes to a surrender. And not only being treated properly in terms of how they should be recognized by their official title, but doing so in terms of not taking anything of theirs and that's valuable, such as their swords. So it is fair to say that there was a time in war when officers did treat one another properly, as long as the officers knew how to fight. Not only it wasn't so much that they knew how to fight properly, but they knew how to fight when the odds were against them. Master Commandant Thomas McDonough wrote to William Jones, the Navy Secretary, advising that the American naval forces had prevailed on Lake Champlain Sunday, September 11th. He wrote in his letter to Navy Secretary Jones that the American forces had captured one frigate, one brig, and two sloops of war. I didn't know about this particular island along Lake Champlain until I had read this book, and I did a little bit more research on it, but it is very important that this island gets mentioned because it has a story unto itself following the Battle of Lake Champlain, but even leading up to the actual battle come September 11th. The island is known as Crab Island. It's a 40-acre limestone island along Lake Champlain's waters. It just so happens that Crab Island became a makeshift hospital where soldiers from both sides got treated. Thomas McDonough released 47 British soldiers whom were badly injured by sending them back to Isle aux Noix. 367 represented the total number of British prisoners whom were sent south via steamer or steamboat, the steamboat known as the Vermont. Why is Crab Island so important behind what took place leading up to the official Battle of Plattsburgh? For one, the military hospital on the island was designed to house soldiers whom were unable to fight due to medical conditions beyond their control. So in other words, if many of these men from both sides could not fight, were not able to fight leading up to September 11th or come September 11th itself, it was because of illnesses in which they did not want to spread to other comrades, or perhaps wounds that they simply could not recover from in enough time. But in the aftermath of the naval battle, the dead or deceased from both sides, being 150 total, this is very powerful, folks. In the aftermath of the naval battle, the deceased from both sides being 150 total got buried side by side in graves that were not marked. So in other words, there is no marking on Crab Island that says a plot for British deceased, a plot for American naval crewmen deceased. In other words, 150 men from both sides got buried side by side in graves that were not marked. Only 91 of the 150 deceased men are known by their names. I did the math, and that's roughly 61%. 61% are known by their names, but we don't know, for example, we don't know if 91 of the 150 deceased men are known by their names, We don't know if a majority of the 91 were United States or if a majority were British. Regardless of whose side they were on, I think it is very proper and fitting that 150 were buried side by side in graves that weren't marked regardless of what side they fought. In other words, maybe it's fair to say that both sides should be buried side by side, knowing that when you die, you don't die alone, that you can often die next to someone from the opposing side, but that when you do get buried next to someone, just know that both sides made sacrifices. One side was trying to conquer the other. The other was trying to fight for the survival of their nation so that the opposing enemy would not conquer that nation, but strip it of its national sovereignty or strip it of its independent sovereignty status. But being placed side by side, to me, is just a very fitting and tributing testament. U.S. forces, their withdrawal from Plattsburgh saw buildings and dwellings remain in a state of disarray. The militia in Aiken's and Aiken's Rifle Company left on September 12th. Combat fighting entirely ceased. While combat fighting did entirely cease, repercussions, for better and for worse, were to soon be felt at home and abroad. Repercussions for the better at home, being in the United States. Abroad, to me, would be both Canada and England, but more so England, because we do have to be reminded that the majority of those living in Canada, if not all Canadians, enjoy being subjects to the crown. It's just that the British government is going to bear the brunt of this defeat. And I'm not so sure if it's going to be the only defeat that the British government will have to bore the brunt of, because something tells me that another battle is looming to the south along the Chesapeake Bay, a battle that is going to rejuvenate not just so much the people of the Chesapeake Bay, but also will see another level of rejuvenation for the United States, given that once again, her status as an independent sovereign nation is still lying in the threshold for survival. But the United States, once again, does have something good to feel about, because, you know, 1813, for the victories at Lake Erie, at Fort Meigs, Fort Stevenson, and present-day Fremont, Ohio, the United States now has something even stronger to feel about, especially in the aftermath of the burnings, the burning of Washington. 2 weeks earlier, we were not in a good place. We were humiliated. 2 weeks later, we have passed a test that many said probably could not have been done, even those on our own home soil. But now we have done something amazing. David has slewed Goliath. But even though David has slewed Goliath in Plattsburgh along Lake Champlain, we still have to learn about the repercussions that will be felt in Canada and in the United States. So that's what we will be discussing about when I'm on the air again next time. Thank you for being such ardent listeners. And when I'm on the air again next, we have a lot more to look forward to learning about. And for those of you out there whom know of others whom would like to be a part of my podcast series discussions, tell them to come to Anchor. Once they get on there, they won't regret it, but they will find that it's well worth their time. Thank you as always, and wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe.